Okay, thank you very much. We resume the workshop, and we welcome Professor Andrea Giussani. Professor Giussani is Professor of Civil Procedure Law at the University of Urbino in Italy, and now is member of the International Association of Procedural Law and of the Société de Législation Comparée. And he's currently working in the American Law Institute project on UNIDROIT and has published extensively about class actions. And today he's going to talk us about proof of causation in group litigation. You have the floor.
Thank you very much. May I speak on one?
Yes, of course.
Wait a minute, because I think the microphone doesn't work. Okay, I speak from here. Let's just say.
Now you have the microphone.
I am not as many of the attendants here English mother tongue. I will read my paper very slowly. Group litigation is now a worldspread reality. Not only US class actions provide for aggregate resolution of mass claims. In many civil law systems, group litigation devices allow simultaneous adjudication of repetitive lawsuits more easily than traditional joinder mechanisms. However, underscoring a difference may be useful. Sometimes group actions are means to dispose of aggregates' individual rights. Sometimes, by contrast, the action is a means to vindicate properly collective rights. This depends largely from cultural differences. Common law systems are much less inclined to waive individualism. In civil law systems, availability of a group litigation device often automatically implies construction of a collective right, especially because civil law systems generally do not face the problem of reconciling the impact of procedural reforms on substantive law. With the American, especially the American federal courts, limits to the court's rule-making powers in matters of procedure. European procedural law coming directly from the legislative branch does not meet the constraints of the American Rules Enabling Act. Importance of this difference for the proof of causation lies in the factual issues respectively involved. A collective right is naturally vindicated by a collective remedy. Hence, relevant facts as well have a collective dimension. Aggregation of individual claims, by contrast, generally implies relevance of individual facts. The easiest example of modern collective rights in civil law systems is given by litigation for the protection of the environment.
European scholars often construe a right to clean air as a collective right, because the owner of a right to clean air cannot forbid access to that same facility by anybody else. Hence, according to this analysis, standing to vindicate that right should be given to anybody, or could be a matter of adequacy of representation with respect to the whole human race. But this means that any violation of that right is relevant in the same way for any plaintiff. Hence, that fact is relevant as a purely collective fact, insofar as an injunctive remedy is at issue, because no difference between the actual plaintiff and anybody else would be relevant for the disposition of the lawsuit. Proving that the defendant caused or even is going to cause a damage to the environment would suffice. However, if the plaintiff pursues a damages award or enforcement of the injunctive remedy, the collective nature of the right may collapse into an individual dimension. From the traditional European point of view, as a general rule, only award of actual of compensatory damages is allowed. Hence, the specific individual plaintiff's sufferings are relevant. Moreover, only the individual plaintiff that actually moved for an injunction can subsequently enforce it. American propensity to rely on private law for deterrence may suggest that even these circumstances could deserve a group perspective. On a procedural side, an injunctive class suit may allow an unnamed class member's enforcement of the remedy. On a substantive side, punitive damages may windfall on a lightly damaged plaintiff in order to protect the general public. But these devices alone do not dispose of relevance of individual facts, insofar as the substantive right does not have the same content for everybody. A less simple case, in fact, is given by litigation on employment discrimination. A facially neutral employment practices disparate impact is relevant as a collective effect. But the right to live in an environment free from discriminatory hiring practices is not generally construed as a right of everybody. In fact, it is generally assumed that only members of the adversely affected group, or their adequate representatives, or public authorities, can enjoy the unlawful conduct, and not the, I'm using Latin, quisque de populo, we used to say anybody. I don't know how they would pronounce it in English. Quisque de populo, perhaps, I don't know. Hence, individual facts may be relevant even if the plaintiff moves only for a collective remedy. The most complex and important case for the issue of proof of causation as a collective or an individual fact, however, is obviously given by mass torts. From the traditional point of view of civil law systems, tort law provides only individual compensation. Courts award damages only to compensate plaintiffs for the specific sufferings respectively proven on an individual basis to be a direct consequence of defendant's unlawful conduct. If the same fact is relevant for many suits in tort, judicial economy justifies consolidation in a single trial, but not a class action. Intentional torts may be a matter for criminal law. American reliance on tort law for deterrence changes the picture, but American reluctance to waive individualism complicates it considerably. As a counter-incentive to intentional tort, punitive damages may encourage private law enforcement, but only a plaintiff suffering actual damages is also entitled to the reward. Mass torts class actions may be allowed, but only insofar as the common issues actually predominate over the individual ones. Hence, albeit both punitive damages and class suits may serve non-individual interests, vindication of individual rights remains a priority, and relevance of individual facts is not disposed of. The ensuing tension turns out especially with the issue of causation. The use of statistics to prove causation in court largely reflects the difference sketched above between collective and individual facts. Statistical proof of employment practices' disparate impact are well known both in the US and the EU. And according to European law, even merely descriptive statistics may suffice for a, that's still late in prima facie, evidence, I don't know, of discrimination. A burden of proof that the disparate impact is not caused by a discriminatory attitude may lie on the defendant upon a simple showing that a gender is underrepresented in proportion to the available workforce. Obviously, these statistics fall short from proving causation from a scientific point of view. Not only because statistical correlation is not enough in itself to prove causation, but also because even statistical significance may be overlooked. According to Italian law, it is up to the defendant to allege that a high variation is nonetheless non-significant because the number of the involved employees is very low. For this analysis, however, the main point is that the same law provides only a group remedy. The court can only order to take an affirmative action to remedy the wrongful act with respect to the discriminated group as a whole, and not with respect to the actual individual victims of the unlawful behavior. These victims may collaterally sue the employer for damages, but in this case, they must show specific causation of actual damages. Tort actions for compensatory damages in civil law systems show the same problem in a more general way. Statistics may suffice as evidence of general causation, insofar as they satisfy criteria to reach an inherently provisional scientific conclusion in support of it. But only damages proven to be specifically caused by the defendant's conduct through individually tailored evidence can be restored. A different rule may apply when a breach of contract is alleged. According to Italian case law, the burden of disproving, that is, to prove the contrary of, at least specific causation, if not general causation as well, may lie on the defendant. But this implies, anyway, both an individually tailored evidence of the contractual relationship and an individually tailored evidence of actually suffered damages. American punitive damages provide a limited detachment from the individual perspective. Since their function is discouraging intentional tort, they are tailored on the defendant's wrongful acts. However, they do not lead as such to statistical proof or specific causation. An important field for the use of statistics, by contrast, is the other public law device in tort litigation, that is, the class action. Class suits do ask for statistical evidence according to both their main rationales, as an instrument to provide low-cost access to justice in litigation between repeat players and one-shot dealers, and as an instrument of judicial economy. From the point of view of judicial economy, individually tailored evidence could almost disappear in the extreme case, repetitive litigation could be disposed of wholesale through sampling. In this perspective, not only evidence of general causation may be given through statistics supported by theory, but let me incidentally, Columbus' discovery of America was evoked just today. It's interesting to note that not only Columbus discovered America looking for something else, but also he discovered it based upon a very wrong theory. But so just a parenthesis to that. But for litigation, just stay with the theory, at least try to. Individually tailored evidence with respect to specific causation of damages to the sample parties may be used as statistical evidence of specific causation of damages to the other group members. From the point of view of access to justice, several scholars pointed out how class actions can balance the scales of justice between repeat players and one-shot dealers with respect to the standard of proof of the preponderance of the evidence on specific causation. The main example is given when there is a significant, and I stress significant, epidemiological evidence supported by a reasonable theory showing that less than 50% of the occurrences of a disease among the group affected by a defendant's conduct are not casual. And hence, from the legal standpoint, may be considered specifically caused by that conduct. In an individual suit, the plaintiff would just lose because the odds are against him. But if all the victim's claims are necessarily conveyed in a single lawsuit and adjudicated wholesale, award of damages corresponding to the percentage of occurrences whose specific causation is proven this way would be possible with respect to the entire group. The difficult question with this approach is if individually tailored evidence of specific causation should be introduced when the globally determined damages are to be distributed among the class members. Insofar as damages do not compensate the mere risk of developing a disease, but the disease actually caused, specific causation should be proven at least in the distribution stage. But in this case, the preponderance of the evidence rule would again defeat every claim. But if a class action settlement provides for a fund to be distributed among the group members, issues of specific causation may be waived altogether. Every illness is paid, and the value of the risk of uncertainty may be correspondingly distributed equally among them. Critics of this approach may object that it would lead to a distortion of substantive law, especially in the US, where the sources of law require a comparatively restrictive scope of the concept of procedure. According to the criteria of the outcome of the litigation, procedural aggregation would become a substantive law device. A possible reply is that the distortion is a consequence of the terms of a settlement. But this leads to the main issue from a comparative standpoint of the class action system, that is, the opt-out mechanism. Even if the defendant should be free to dispose of the need of individually tailored evidence of specific causation, and always, and often he's eager to do it because, as far as I know, I mean, if I'm not wrong, it was exactly in the Benedictine case that the defendant moved for a mandatory certification, for the certification of the mandatory class. Am I right? It was one of those cases, perhaps Benedictine, I'm not sure, but one of them. Asbestos happened often. Well, even if that is true, disposal of that issue with respect to the distribution among class members may prejudice some of them because, at least sometimes, in the individual litigation, they would not always be on an equal footing. Additional evidence on specific causation may sometimes be available for only a part of the group. The stronger cases, hence, would prefer an individual lawsuit, but the defendant may be inclined to settle only with respect to the group as a whole. Judicial economy would obviously dictate a preference for global settlements, but fears of distorting substantive law push in the opposite direction. Many civil law systems provide for grouping of individual rights only through spurious opt-in class actions, on the premise that on constitutional grounds, the right of action may not be disposed of by default. This extreme position, in my view, is not sound. In fact, inferring consent by silence is generally possible in civil law systems when no obligation derived to the right holder and the right holder has both an option to refuse the disposal and a timely notice of that option. Hence, in the Italian system, according to the prevailing view, a statute providing that a judgment bounds every class member who did not opt out after receiving notice of the pendency of the action would not violate constitutional law. Serious problems of constitutional law, however, do arise in continental Europe if opt-out is not available because a class action is mandatory, or if opt-out is not allowed with respect to a settlement. As far as a grouping of individual rights and not purely group rights are involved, individual right of action cannot be deleted this way. US 21st century developments of mass-tort class action settlements, however, suggest that the dilemma may anyway turn around the same poles on both sides of the Atlantic. Insofar as punitive damages are not a compensation, but rather a bounty for a protection of what may be seen as a group right, the right to live in an environment free from intentional torts, after settlement, late opt-out may be limited to claims for compensatory damages. With this approach, a wholesale resolution of punitive damages claims may pursue optimal deterrence better than a piecemeal one, while individual right of action is preserved only with respect to the rights that also civil law systems would consider plainly individual. Only vindication of these rights outside group litigation, hence, actually requires proof of specific causation. European hostility towards punitive damages should not lead to overlook an analogy. Private enforcement of public interests do exist, and a bounty may be often available through injunctive suits, because the plaintiff may cash in money from the defendant for every occurrence of non-compliance to the remedy, with no need to prove any actual suffering, let alone their specific causation. But insofar as a conduct damages a group, this bounty comes from the collapse of a group right into an individual one described above. Individual right of action and individually tailored proof of specific causation remain the general rule insofar as the law provides only compensation of actual individual sufferings. In this case, relevant facts are not purely collective. Thanks for your attention.
Thank you very much, Professor Giussiani. And now we start the debate about this interesting presentation. Who's going to talk first? No questions? All very clear? Please, proceed. Microphone, please. Who's in charge?
Well, my question is related to punitive damages and this correlation that you make, like private law in Europe is more about compensation and private law in the US is really focused on deterrence. And my problem is that if we think about punitive damages, we will all agree that the functions of punitive damages are punishment and deterrence. What that exactly means, that's a question, because we can think about punishment in at least two different ways, like private punishment that would invoke the idea of private sanction and the idea of vindication, and that could be an individual basis, punitive damages argument. But we can also think about punitive damages, a punishment as a public punishment idea and this kind of public enforcement you were meaning when we are talking about undisabled business torts or antisocial behavior that we want to deter. And also we can talk about optimal deterrence. I think you mentioned the last words. And that would be a completely different rationale of punitive damages that we could play in civil law countries, and I think that in the US they have pretty similar complex situation. And so I'm not so, I mean, when we are willing to think about aggregation or punitive damages in civil law systems, I think that we should reconsider what deterrence actually means. And I don't know, I think I am kind of willing to think that we need to consider optimal deterrence as well, or what is complete versus optimal deterrence. I mean, I don't know. I think there is something there that civil law countries or systems should be more open to consider. And it's the same with class actions. I mean, if we think we really want to aggregate in these cases of economical damages, that the amount of damage is $1 or something like this, we are not thinking about compensation of the victims. We are thinking about deterring the tortfeasor. So I think there is a lot there going on that, I mean, I would like to think in that way. I don't know if you agree, but. And the other thing is that actually, I think that you mentioned that punitive damages do not ask for general causation. And I think I will disagree. You didn't say that? Oh, okay, because, well, I would disagree in that point, but I understood that. Well, I don't know, I'm sorry?
I mean, if you prove specific causation of compensatory damages, you can get, if you also prove intentional torts, the bounty of punitives. But also you must before, as I said, you must before yeah. prove that there are compensatory damages to pay, and punitives as compensatory multiplied.
Yes, maybe someone from professors from the US can help me. I am thinking about the Philip Morris, the 2008 case. I think there was an issue with this general causation thing because they allowed a plaintiff to prove reprehensibility of all the scope of the conduct because the idea was to sanction this behavior. But it was an individual case. And they say, well, we could consider the scope of the conduct, but just to judge the reprehensibility, if this subjective intentional element was there. But we only consider, in order to determine the quantity of the punitive damages, we should consider the individual case on hand. I think it was some kind of, it could be a contradictory standard, but that was, I think, at play. But I don't know, that's all.
Well, in some sense, you may say there is a contradiction, that, and it's what I try to underscore. You point out on the main issues here, and obviously what is taken as a premise is the old story of the cathedral, you know. With respect to... with respect to breach of contract, we reason in some way. With respect to torts, we reason in another way, depending on the fact that we had or we did not have the opportunity to negotiate in advance the effects of a conduct between the interested parties, I mean. With respect to the problem of optimal deterrence, you must consider that even if you are dealing with intentional torts, so you are out of the perspective of mere compensation, you still may have some problems of optimal deterrence from the old point of view of criminal law. That is, you should sanction a conduct not worse than a worse conduct. So there is a limit of even public law sanctions or punitive damages to be determined. The limits determined from the idea that you should not encourage a worse conduct that would not be subject to this kind of punitive damages. And actually, we have seen class litigation as, especially in recent years, very often, as a means to contain the amount of punitive damages, because through series of individual lawsuits, it has been said, they would be amount complexively to a far bigger sum than what would derive from just a complex global adjudication wholesale. It would be an advantage for a defendant to have punitive damages determined once and for all. At least this is what has been very, very often said. The second part of the question, what was it? Especially, I'm not sure to remember. Oh, I say the thing that I didn't say. No, I didn't actually say. Mm-hmm.
Okay, thank you. Gentlemen, you have a question? Yes.
Actually, I believe for more explanation of the Philip Morris case in the U.S. And I think that in the U.S. as well as in the civil law countries is that the notion is that not properly based on deterrence. They're based more on compensation. Well, battery gone? No, it's just flaky. All right. There's an incongruity in the U.S. because there's two general theories of punitive damages, and one of which is that that they are meant to punish, right? And they're meant to kind of punish in a criminal law sort of way for the bad conduct that was done in a criminal law sort of way to the public as a whole, and to deter that sort of conduct for the future. But there's a different sort of idea, which I think is more the idea in the civil law, and used to be the idea in the U.S. and still is in some states like Michigan, that punitive damages really are compensatory, that they compensate for the insult and the indignity. And in that sense, you call them aggravated damages in the United Kingdom as opposed to exemplary. You call them Germany, you know, so there is, even though people say that we don't have them in civil law, we have them, we kind of treat them as compensatory, satisfaction, aggravation for the insult, the disrespect, the indignity to the individual. And that used to be the view in the U.S., like I say, it still hangs on in some states, but somehow we kind of moved toward a different view of punitive damages as a backstop to criminal law, and the courts even say this, the Supreme Court says this, that this punitive damages are not to redress a wrong to the individual. that the individual is merely sort of a private attorney general and they're getting a bit of a windfall, but it's a contingency sort of fee that encourages being a private attorney general. But at the same time, in the recent cases, including Philip Morris, they've restricted the damages down to having to prove the wrong done to this individual. So they're kind of coming closer and closer to the idea this really is for the wrong to the individual in terms of the damages you have to pay, even though they still view it as somehow a backstop to criminal law. So there's a very strong incongruity and dissonance in the theory of punitive damage in the U.S. But on the reprehensibility issue, what they've said, and it is a bit confusing, they've said that reprehensibility, and they say not deterrence. In fact, they rejected a law on economics brief on efficient deterrence and so on. They said it's not deterrence. The major factor is reprehensibility. And they said that you're not allowed to kind of get damages as they allowed in previous cases, even though they said not based on, well, it wasn't just me, it was 500 other people they did it to, and let's sort of therefore multiply times 500 to kind of get it all at once. No, you can only get for the wrong done to you, right? But you're allowed to show the wrong done to you is greater from a reprehensibility standpoint than it otherwise would be, given the fact this person is doing it to a lot of people. So the fact they're doing it to a lot of people shows how little they care about any individual. So that it's sort of a theory of you're allowed to use evidence of others they've done this to show that they don't care about any individual, and they care less about any individual because it's not just you, they don't care about anybody in society. So they're allowing this kind of overall, looking at the larger group it's been done to enhance reprehensibility, but reprehensibility in terms of what you've done to this individual. So it's a bit confusing, I think, but that's the theory. And, you know, some justices say that's a very hard line to get a jury to understand, but that's what they're allowing now. But what they haven't done, and they're still concerned, because if we view them as a backstop to criminal law, we don't have all the criminal law protections. You know, we don't have against the double jeopardy rule. We don't have the same beyond a reasonable doubt standard. We have different discovery sort of rules, you know, very different procedures. And they're still, even though they kind of say, well, it's tort, it's not crime. But they're starting to kind of worry more about that. And again, if you have, if you say it's really a backstop to criminal law, you shouldn't have more than one case. Just one case, that's it. If it's an individual thing, it's an individual wrong to each individual can bring the action. So I think in the U.S., there's still an awful lot of confusion about the theoretical foundations and consistency of punitive damages.
Thank you very much. I know what you say. There is a strong, very big detail also in the concept of punitive damages also. Obviously, I stressed the interpretation that fits in my theory. Obviously, the interpretation that punitive damages are a way to compensate some kind of sufferings that are difficult to calculate. This would not make a very big comparison because we also have it in Europe. So there would not be a difference. But what is interesting from the comparative point of view is exactly the idea of introducing an instrument to deter some kind of intentional torts in civil law systems and in private law, I'm meaning. In private law adjudication. Obviously, this has to do partly with the loopholes of criminal law effectivity, largely due to the problem of protecting the procedural rights of the defendant, so that's an old story, how many guilty acquittal we would accept in order to eliminate any risk of an innocent conviction. Yeah, 10, 1,000, 100, depending on the point of view, and also has to do with the fact that obviously criminal law is enforced by public authorities that need money to work, while from the American point of view, self-interested a plaintiff may be motivated to do what taxpayers don't want to spend for the public authorities, and many of the characters of the American law that seem very, very odd from the European point of view generally have this justification, like the bail system, for example. From the European point of view, the idea that anyone who committed even a very minor crime should be arrested and then immediately released after a bail, this is completely absurd. It's nonsense. But the practical reality beside that rule is that it is a way to privatize detention of the defendant before trial, because it's the guy who pays the bail who controls it. It's a private entrepreneur that risks his own money on his ability to take the defendant to trial and have powers to look for the defendant trying to escape that even the public authorities don't have. So they can enter a house without a warrant, and they can pass interstate borders with firearms to run after the fugitive defendants. So it's actually a way to have private entrepreneurs doing the job that in Europe generally do public authorities. That's not always release the defendant, but depending on the seriousness of the case, of the seriousness of the crime, and so on. But it's the American way of doing things.
Okay, thank you. Professor Strong.
Thank you. I hope that I heard you right, and I'm not going to misspeak something that you said, but I believe that you mentioned that the United States restricts the scope of procedure because to do otherwise would possibly elevate procedural law to substantive law. Is that correct? Well, okay. And to me, this is a very interesting concept because I work with the cross-border concept of mass torts. And both the United States Supreme Court and the Supreme Court of Canada have been dealing recently with the nature of a collective right or a class right, whether it is indeed procedural or not. And this, I think, is very important in the cross-border context because of the role that the class or the collective mechanism plays in terms of the regulatory scheme. Should that be exported? Should it have extraterritorial effect, conflicts of law issues, and I was wondering whether you had thought about that concept at all. I realize you were talking a little bit more about causation, but whether you had any thoughts on that issue.
It's a very great topic. I thank you very much because, in fact, this is what is exactly what I was trying to say. Since there is this system of sources of law. That authorities court to rule make, but only matters of procedure, and so Americans generally have a very, very restrictive concept of procedure. Almost many, many issues of law that are considered procedural law in civil law systems are considered substantive law in the U.S., not only issues of evidence, but also status of limitation. Res judicata is often considered a matter for substantive law, while traditional ideas in Europe about the distinction of substance and procedure with respect to choice of laws issues, especially in transnational litigation, generally come to the conclusion that res judicata is a matter of procedure and so on. So this is a very important difference.
And if I just may, enraged power would be incredibly important in the context of class and collective actions, because if it's considered substantive in some jurisdictions, then we're going to have massive issues when we come time to enforce a foreign judgment arising out of class and collective. Thank you. You have helped immensely.
Thank you. Okay. More questions? No? You want to add something, perhaps?
Thank you very much for the attendance.